Have you ever noticed that times of crisis are often a huge catalyst for an organized progression of change? We see this looking back on history, the Great Depression, World War II, even the recent financial downturn of the global market. Yet the most current changes seem to be more drastic and more permanent than those of the past. Today here on Turning Point, Dr. David Jeremiah will show us how these changes are the beginning of the ever-increasing presence of the global economy as he continues his series, The Coming Economic Armageddon. Now, here's David.
Well, thank you for joining us today. A brand new week and a brand new topic as we explore the coming economic Armageddon. Today, we're going to talk about the new global economy and what it means, what it stands for, how it develops, and how we as Christians should fit into it or not fit into it, according to the scripture. And we'll get started with that discussion in just a few moments. By the way, this is the third chapter in a book that we have just completed and released called The Coming Economic Armageddon. And if you would like to have a copy of this book, this 291-page hardback book will be sent to you for a gift of any size during the month of October. Simply ask for your copy of The Coming Economic Armageddon when you send your gift to Turning Point today. We also want to remind you that we are now in the week of our first fall rally. This coming Thursday night, October the 14th, we're going to be at the Greensboro Coliseum at 7 p.m. We've had an incredible response to this particular rally, and we're looking forward to one of the largest attendances we have ever had at any event Turning Point has ever produced. But there's still room for you if you would like to come. The tickets are free, but you must have a ticket, and you can order them by going to our order line, or better yet, to davidjeremiah.org/rallies. Order your tickets today, and we will have them waiting for you at will call the night of the event. That event is right on us, and we don't want to wait any longer to make reservations. I hope you will do it today. And pastors, don't forget, there's still room for you at the pastor's breakfast. That's the morning of the rally, the morning of October the 14th. And once again, this is a free breakfast, and we'll be giving copies of the new book to every pastor who attends. Information about that event is also available at davidjeremiah.org, and we'll be welcoming you in just a few days. The new global economy is our discussion for today. That's right. There's an economy that embraces the whole world. It's already in its incipient form, beginning right now, and we are participating. What is this all about, and what does it mean? It's next right here on Turning Point.
How many of you know we're living in some awesome times? Unprecedented times, times we never dreamed we'd ever see in our life. And to try to sort it all out is more than a full-time job. And I promise you, I'm not going to answer all your questions. I'm going to create a few new ones you didn't have. Armageddon seemed to arrive in Manhattan on Monday, September 29th, 2008. Not just in New York, but in Moscow, Hong Kong, London, Frankfurt. And then on Tuesday, plagues and locusts were loosed on the world. The U.S. stock market fell hard again. Japan was sinking into the sea. Brazil's market was down 51% year to date. Central banks were cutting rates like pulpwood. Even so, unemployment was still on the rise, and consumer spending was falling. House prices were going down. I give you that paragraph only because it is strange to find those words written by secular financial writers. William Bonner and Addison Wiggin describe the current economic woes with biblical imagery. They call it Armageddon. I doubt if they even know what that means in terms of the Bible, except that it's an awful time, and it's a word we usually pull up to describe something beyond description. It seems like when crises are large enough, the word Armageddon starts getting its time in the spotlight. Is Armageddon too strong a word for what's happened to us over this last year? Well, I don't know if the answer to that is yes or no. But if you experience a worldwide crisis, you should expect it to have long-term implications. Crises are interesting, aren't they? Crises are catalysts to an organized progression of changes. And there's little doubt that the world has been driven toward greater globalization by the crises we have been experiencing. In his book, When a Nation Forgets God, Erwin Lutzer, one of my good friends, tells the story of Germany's economic crisis and what happened because of it. Here's what he said. He said, "Let us not be quick to condemn those who were willing to give Hitler a chance, given the economic chaos that spread through Germany after World War I. He could have never come to power if the German economy would have remained strong after World War I. He rode to victory simply because he promised to rebuild the collapsing German mark and put the nation back to work. He cleverly exploited the economic crisis of post-war Germany, and yet it was the economy that gave rise to National Socialism." Earlier, I wrote about what happened in Germany some years ago when I wrote another book on prophecy. And in that book, I talked about the fact that the German treasury was low in gold and the budget was unbalanced. Inflation went out of sight. In 1919, the German mark was worth 25 cents. And within 4 years, it declined in value until 4 trillion marks were needed to equal the buying power of $1. The German middle class lost all of its savings, and every pension in the nation was wiped out. In 1929, the global depression hit Germany and gave Hitler the opportunity to make his move. And when Austria's biggest bank collapsed, it forced the banks in Berlin to close temporarily. And Germany was unable to make its war payments. And millions were unemployed as thousands of small businesses were wiped out. Deprived of jobs and a decent living, ravaged by hunger, the Germans were willing to do anything just to survive. Today's proponents of the one world economy embrace the philosophy of a man by the name of George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, a German philosophy of the 1880s. Hegel theorized that by planning and actually producing crises, leaders could gain economic power by stepping in and promising solutions. Now, if this sounds rather familiar to you, I'm not trying to be familiar. I'm just telling you what's going on. Despite all of this, desperate people will give power to those who seem to have the answers to their crises. As a result, now listen to this, little by little, fewer and fewer make more and more of the decisions. Little by little, fewer and fewer make more and more of the decisions. Hegel's words are haunting for those of us who observe the workings of our own government here in this country. Using crises and other manipulations, our leaders have now discovered a way to bypass the checks and balances that were put in place by our forefathers. How do they do it? They simply appoint czars to manage the crisis, bypassing representational solutions and reporting only to the president. A series of recent crises have led to increased government control in our own country. Government-imposed loan standards precipitated a banking crisis, which was solved by a government bailout and the control of the banks. As a result, little by little, fewer and fewer are making more and more banking decisions. Government regulations and union concessions produced an automobile industry crisis, resulting in a government takeover of a huge manufacturer. And now, little by little, fewer and fewer are making more and more corporate automobile decisions. Government solutions produced a health care crisis, resulting in a government takeover of national health care. And now, little by little, fewer and fewer are making more and more health care decisions. Little by little, we are being prepared for the coming centralized government of the final world order and a global economy. Now, when we talk about the global economy, what do we mean? Let me give you a little history lesson that I had to learn on my own. I didn't know this before I did this study, but I'd like to bring you up to date on what I've observed and what I've learned. Webster adds the term globalization to the dictionary as recently as 1951. And here is the definition of globalization in Webster's dictionary. The development of an increasingly integrated global economy marked especially by free trade, free flow of capital, and the tapping of cheaper foreign labor markets. Most historians and economists believe that the current global economy began in 1944 at the official beginning of the global economy. As World War II was winding down, 730 of the world's leading politicians from all 44 allied nations convened at a place that I've actually visited. It's near where Donna grew up in New Hampshire. It's the Mount Washington Hotel in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. It's a beautiful old historic hotel. The Bretton Woods Conference was the culmination of a 2.5-year planning time for post-war monetary reconstruction. The nations were getting together to figure out how they were going to survive everything that happened in the Second World War. It resulted in history's first example of a fully negotiated monetary order intended to govern currency among several nations. The delegates were challenged to establish rules for global commerce, to find new ways to facilitate international trade, and to stabilize international exchange rates. In response, the Bretton Woods delegates gave birth to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, and the World Bank Group, and the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. Three organizations, keep that in the back of your mind. The World Bank makes loans to poor countries for capital infrastructure programs. The International Monetary Fund is attuned to economic control in the future. It oversees the global financial policies of member nations. It provides loans to poor countries as well. And both the World Bank and the IMF have a presence in 186 countries in the world. At the Bretton Woods Conference, each country obligated itself to a monetary policy which was based on the gold standard. They agreed to maintain the integrity of their currencies from the framework of a fixed value, and that value was set at plus or minus 1% of the gold regulated at U.S. $35 per ounce. According to one expert, the delegates at Bretton Woods wanted to create a system that would eventually evolve into a global currency and a global monetary system. This was the beginning of the economic side of building a new world order, and it's been unfolding rather steadily ever since, a little time by a little time, since 1944. Bretton Woods established the United States dollar as the reserve currency of the world because at that particular time, America had the world's largest and most stable economy, and we had the most dollars or the most units of currency of any country in the world. Since the end of World War II, the United States dollar has continued to be the reserve currency of the world in spite of the fact that the U.S. no longer backs up its dollars with gold. In other words, just as central banks once issued their currencies as a marker for gold under the Bretton Woods Agreement, now they issue their currencies against the United States dollar, which they use as a backup for their own currency, even though the United States dollar is no longer backed up by the gold standard. The amount of U.S. dollars in their possession determines the volume and the value of the currency they issue. Now, maybe you've never heard this term before. If you've had, you've wondered, what does it mean, the reserve currency? Well, it simply means the currency that is used as the value standard for other currencies. In other words, it is usually considered to be the most trusted, stable currency in the world by virtue of the issuing nation's stability and trustworthiness. This means that universal commodities like oil and gold are priced in terms of the reserve currency all over the world. The U.S. dollar is that currency right now. That gives the United States a real edge in commodities because we have plenty of dollars and we don't have to get exchanges for our dollars, so we save the exchange rates. As I speak, almost two-thirds of foreign currency reserves today in the whole world are held in dollars. And that has made the United States the world financial leader for the past 60 years. But don't get used to it and don't hang on to it. Things are changing. In January of 2010, Congress raised the ceiling for our national debt to $14.2 trillion. And our growing debt is causing investors around the United States and around the world great anxiety over the U.S. dollar. The anxiety is generating apprehension among other nations. One economist put it this way: as they watch America's debt soar, some of the passengers aboard the Dollar Debt Express have reached for the emergency cord in hopes that they can stop the train and get off. In August of 2009, the Wall Street Journal reported that doubts about the dollar were growing as budget deficits continued to balloon. The journal quoted global economic strategists as saying, "There's been a lot of disappointment with the way the U.S. credit crisis was handled, and the dollar's loss of influence is a steady and long-term trend." Former U.S. Deputy Secretary Treasury Roger Altman, after describing the financial crisis of 2008 as the worst crisis in over 75 years, went on to make this statement. He said, trends are shifting the world's center of gravity away from the United States. Much of the world is turning a historic corner and heading into a period in which the role of the state will be larger and the private sector will be smaller. This historic crisis raises the question of whether a new global approach is going to work to control banking financial systems in the world. I don't read Robert Kiyosaki. He's a pretty contemporary writer. He's the guy who's written all the Rich Dad, Poor Dad books that are out on the columns that you see as you go in the bookstores. But he contains a little blurb in the thing he wrote called Why the Dollar is Toast. And in this book, he said, the dollar is losing its power as the reserve currency of the world. In other words, the American empire of debt is coming to an end. Now, here's a fact from top-ranked global economist Wilfred J. Hahn that you may not know. A long time ago, it was realized. In fact, way back in the inception of the world current monetary regime, that the United States dollar was fated to lose its central role. Why is that? Listen carefully. We have decided that we have to be the currency backbone of the world. The United States needs to run deficits so that we can supply U.S. dollars to the rest of the world. This can only be done for so long before mounting international debts, which would overwhelm the United States, and indeed, that is part of what is happening today. Did you ever stop and think about that? We are in debt up to our ears, and we keep loaning money to other people. How do you do that? If you don't have any money yourself, how do you loan money to other people? You don't do it for very long before you get yourself in a lot of trouble. Larry Kudlow, the anchor at CNBC, presented an opinion in the form of a letter to the United States president. He said, we know the dollar is slumping. We need a stable dollar. You need to stop printing so much debt from Congress. And everybody said amen to that. These experts, observers, make it obvious that the nations of the world are aware that America's growing financial stability is in jeopardy. Many nations like Russia, China, Brazil, Taiwan, Sri Lanka have been quietly adding gold to their stock market, and that they're using gold because they're afraid of what's going on with the American dollar. China recently surpassed India as the largest gold-buying nation in the world. If the value of the U.S. dollar is going to drop, they want to hold something that has infinite value to offset the dollar's decline. And that something is the same as it's always been throughout human history. It's gold. So you can almost watch as people begin to increase their holdings of gold. That is an outward symbol of the weakness of the economy because they're afraid of what's going on in the world of the dollar. Fearing a continuing drop in the value of the U.S. dollar, many United States citizens are beginning to buy gold. Do you hear all the commercials about buying gold on the radio and on television? The price of gold rose more than 25% in 2009 due to the investor demand. And for gold to reach its former inflation-adjusted peak of $875 an ounce in 1980, it would have to rise around $2,000 an ounce in 2009 dollars. And it's only around $1,100 an ounce as I speak. So the gold buying train has just begun to leave the station, and it's going to pick up momentum, and you're going to see people buying gold like crazy. In fact, when you get done listening to this message, you're going to go home and find out where you can buy some gold. I can just pretty much tell you that. If the world's nations agree to implement a new universal currency, it will be a way of conveying that the United States is no longer the only stable, trustworthy country in the world. And that is gradually becoming true. The BRIC nations, by the way, the BRIC nations are Brazil, Russia, India, and China, the BRIC nations, are on the ascendancy as America is suffering. If we can't manage our affairs well enough to keep our currency's value above that of others, then perhaps the dollar deserves to lose its reserve currency status. We should not be surprised that at the April 2009 meeting of the G8 nations in London, consisting of the heads of the states of the world's eight richest industrialized nations, Russia's president, Dmitry Medvedev, called for the creation of a new supranational currency, a currency that would transcend national boundaries and national authorities. This new currency would replace the U.S. dollar as the world reserve currency. At the group's subsequent meeting in July, Medvedev showed off a sample coin of the United Future World Currency. The coin bears the imprint Unity in Diversity. The other three members of the BRIC nations joined Russia in its call for a replacement to the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And French President Nicolas Sarkozy added his voice, saying, "We cannot stick with just one single currency." Canada's largest newspaper, The Globe and Mail, ran a story in late 2009 entitled "Calls Rise for a New Global Currency." The article said in part, "The days of one country's currency as the global benchmark are numbered. The U.S. dollar remains the currency standard, but globalization demands a new global currency that provides representation for the growing importance of a variety of major economies." The article went on to quote the former IF official, Eswar Prasad, as saying that the U.S. and China are caught in a dangerous game of chicken that could easily spin out of control. A precipitous action by China to shift out of the U.S. dollar instruments, or even an announcement of such an intention, could act as a trigger that nervous market sentiments coalesce around, leading to a plunge in bond prices and the value of the U.S. dollar. Facing deficits over the next decade, the United States desperately needs China's cash to finance its profligate ways. Isn't it interesting that we are now worried about that? That because we owe them so much money, we have to be so careful about what we say and do. It's a reminder to us that a debtor is in servanthood to the person to whom he owes money. I'm not sure it's a good thing for our nation to be in that kind of a relationship with countries like China and Japan at this particular moment in history. Back in 1920, John Maynard Keynes, who was the most famous British economist and considered by many to be the architect of our current economic system, quoted Lenin in one of his books, and here's what he said. "By a continuing process," now listen carefully, let this run through the grid of what you've been watching and experiencing in our culture today. Listen to this word. This is Lenin, not necessarily an evangelical spokesman. This is Lenin. Listen. "By continuing process of inflation, governments can confiscate, secretly and unobserved, an important part of the wealth of their citizens. There is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. The process engages all the hidden forces of economic law on the side of destruction, and it does so in a manner that not one man in a million is able to diagnose." Listen, what he said is that by a continuous process of inflation, the government can little by little take more and more of the money from the citizenry until they control the citizenry by controlling all the money. Now, if you don't believe that's right, then that means you haven't paid your taxes yet. Just go home and look at what's happening to the tax structure in our culture and what's going to happen next year and the year after. Little by little, the government, by debauching the currency, inflation, doing away with the value of the money, little by little, they take more and more of the money of the citizens, and they do it in such a way that only one man in a million can diagnose it.
Well, these are difficult days, but how free we must feel when we know what is going on, when we can see the truth and understand what it is and how it fits into God's plan, which involves every one of us who are followers of Christ. We'll have more of this tomorrow. I hope you will listen to the next edition of Turning Point here on this good station. Once again, I want to remind you that in just a couple of days, we'll be in Greensboro, North Carolina, at the Greensboro Coliseum for our Thursday night Turning Point rally. If you haven't already requested your tickets, you can still do so and have them waiting for you at will call at the Coliseum. But you need to do it today by going to our website, which is davidjeremiah.org, or calling our order line. We will make the tickets available to you, and you can pick them up the night of the event. And now, before we say our final goodbye today, just a reminder that we will be happy to send you a copy of the brand new book, The Coming Economic Armageddon. All we ask you to do is send a gift of any size to Turning Point during the month of October. And when you do that, you may request your copy of this 291-page book, the longest, most extensive research project I have ever undertaken. And I believe that God will use it to open your eyes and hopefully give you insight into what's happening in the future as we move forward in God's plan. We'll see you right here tomorrow.
If you'd like more information about Dr. Jeremiah's new series, The Coming Economic Armageddon, visit our website at davidjeremiah.org/radio. When you do, look for two great ways to stay connected to Turning Point. Sign up for your free copy of our monthly magazine, Turning Points, or Daily Turning Point, our daily e-devotional. Sign up today by visiting davidjeremiah.org/radio or call us at 800-947-1993. That's 800-947-1993. When you call or visit online, request this month's resource, The Coming Economic Armageddon. This new book by Dr. David Jeremiah addresses aspects of the economic changes in our world and reminds us to keep our trust in God alone, our only true source of safety and security. Order this book for a gift of any amount. Just call or click today. This is Mark Larson. Join us tomorrow as we continue the series, The Coming Economic Armageddon, on Turning Point with Dr. David Jeremiah.